The bituminous sands in Alberta have been embraced by the Canadian government as a major engine of the country's economy and a major reason Canada survived the recession of 2008 better than other countries. How much of a boon has the tar sands been for Canada's economic and energy security? Journalist Andrew Nikiforuk will examine these issues with us in this half hour. And stateside, what is behind the resignation of CIA Director David Petraeus, and how will the map of the Middle East be transformed as President Obama enters his second term and Israel ups its violence in Gaza? We will spend the second half hour with journalist, writer, and broadcaster Stephen Lendman. On today's show, Harper, Petraeus, and Petropolitics. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 15th, 2012. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with some of the major news stories shaping the national and international political landscape. Over the last 24 hours, Gaza has seen an escalation of violence as Israeli airstrikes are being carried out over Gaza territory and Gaza militants are firing rockets at southern Israel in retaliation. The violent attacks come on the heels of the assassination of Hamas's military mastermind, Ahmed al-Jabari. The attack killed 13 people, including 5 militants, 3 children, and a pregnant woman. More than 100 were wounded in the attack. Hamas said the assassination would, quote, open the gates of hell for Israel. Israel has been dropping leaflets into Gaza, calling on residents to stay away from Hamas facilities and militants. Influential Arab powers Egypt and Qatar are censuring the actions by Israel, while the U.S. is condemning Hamas for being an obstacle to peace and for not recognizing Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is stepping up his fight against Gaza with an offensive known as Operation Pillar of Defense, and the Israeli cabinet is mobilizing its military reserves. Egypt has recalled its ambassador and has called for an emergency session of the UN Security Council to be convened to address the situation. In what may become a second Gaza war, Gaza has at its disposal 35,000 Palestinian fighters. Israel has F-16 fighter bombers, Apache helicopter gunships, Merkava tanks, and other modern weapon systems in the hands of 175,000 conscript soldiers, plus 450,000 on reserve. And that comes from Reuters. The long-awaited report on Greece from inspectors appointed by the International Monetary Fund, the European Commission, and the European Central Bank states that Greece has made progress on its reforms, and Eurozone ministers have agreed to give Greece 2 more years to come up with the cuts they agreed to in exchange for financial assistance. A rift between the 3 members of the Troika was reported and affected financial markets when they couldn't agree to whether or not EU governments should write off a portion of the debt. The IMF thought they should, but Germany did not wish to subject taxpayers to real losses in advance of the 2013 general election. If the Mediterranean country were allowed to default on its debt and go bankrupt, it would blow currency union apart. And that comes from Der Spiegel. A first-ever coordinated strike across Europe involving millions of workers was organized for Wednesday, November 14th, in opposition to the austerity measures being imposed on the struggling EU economies like Spain and Portugal. Car factories and ports were shut down, hundreds of flights were canceled, and trains barely ran in Spain and Portugal. The European Day of Action and Solidarity involved disrupting international rail lines in Belgium and planned work stoppages in Greece, Italy, and France. There were 60 arrests in Spain and 34 injuries. Some of the biggest protests against the austerity agenda have been in Spain, where millions have been pushed into poverty by the government's approach to the fiscal crisis. Spaniards are furious that banks are being bailed out while ordinary people suffer. Spain's economy, the fourth biggest in the Eurozone, is expected to shrink by 1.5% this year. Unemployment stands at 25%, with fresh job cuts coming weekly. And that comes from Reuters. Floodwaters have been wreaking havoc in Italy over the past week. Three people died after their car fell off a collapsed bridge near Grosseto. Army units were called in to help relocate locals after sections of a major thoroughfare linking North and South Italy were underwater. A 73-year-old man drowned in his car when it filled with the floodwater near Capablio, and much of the rich farmland of Moremo is now a lake of mud. There has been an increased frequency of disastrous flooding over the past few years. A leading farmers group, Calderetti, is saying a clear pattern of climate change is emerging, which is affecting Italy's agricultural output. A hot Arab summer, followed by the floods, has caused traditional Italian produce to take a hit. The Italian wine harvest is down 6%, the harvest of apples and pears is down 22% and 13%, respectively. Chestnuts down by half and honey by a quarter. And that comes from The Guardian. The head of the CIA, David Petraeus, resigned on Friday, November 9th, citing an extramarital affair, evidence of which surfaced during an FBI investigation of a computer Petraeus had used. Administration and congressional officials identified Paula Broadwell, a West Point graduate and Petraeus's biographer, as the woman in the affair. A probe of Director Petraeus was triggered after a number of threatening emails sent to Jill Kelly of Tampa, Florida, a woman close to Petraeus, identified Broadwell as the source. The scandal also appears to have snared NATO top U.S. commander in Kabul, General John Allen, who had apparently had, according to FBI and Pentagon sources, quote-unquote, inappropriate and flirtatious email exchanges with Jill Kelly. Petraeus was to testify at a closed-door Senate intelligence hearing November 16th on the recent attacks on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, which claimed the life of Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. And that comes from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CBS News. And the Iranian Defense Minister, Brigadier General Ahmad Vahidi, confirmed on Friday, November 9th, that Iranian fighter jets fired upon a U.S. drone the previous day, as was reported by the Pentagon. Vahidi explained in a statement that the shots were intended to shoot away the drone and that, quote, the Islamic Republic of Iran is vigilantly and precisely monitoring all moves and provides decisive, necessary, and prompt response with efficient power, unquote, to any hostile move. The timeline supplied by the Pentagon explained that at about 4:50 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, Su-25 Frogfoot aircraft intercepted the American drone as it flew over Persian Gulf waters about 16 nautical miles off the Iranian coast. The U.S. sent warnings through diplomatic channels, saying it would defend its military assets and keep sending aircraft on similar missions in the Persian Gulf, and that comes from the Fars News Agency. Andrew Nikiforuk is a journalist and author whose writing spans two decades. His numerous articles on energy, economics, and the West appear in The Walrus, Maclean's Canadian Business, The Globe and Mail's Report on Business, Chatelaine, Georgia Strait, and The Taiyi, among others. He's received 7 National Magazine Awards since 1989 and top honors for investigative writing from the Association of Canadian Journalists. His latest book, The Energy of Slaves, Oil, and the New Servitude argues that the energy institution of slavery has shaped our careless use of fossil fuels. I spoke to him recently about Canada's tar sands policy and its overall impacts. I wanted to ask you, first of all, about how Canada's energy policy, how it has transformed, say, over the last few decades or so.
Well, we've seen really a radical transformation in Canada. First and foremost, we were not an energy or an oil exporting nation. And that we have become quite rapidly beginning in the 1990s, to the point now where we are providing the United States with 20% of its oil. In the process of really rapidly developing bitumen as the source of this oil, we've really changed the character of the country. We've changed its economy and we've changed its politics. So politically, we've seen this huge shift in the sense that, you know, Stephen Harper comes from Alberta. Alberta is a petro state. It's been ruled by one party for 42 years. And so Harper has brought all that secrecy, all that concentration of power, all the lack of transparency, and all the bloody arrogance to Ottawa. So that's a huge political change we've seen in the country. We've seen dramatic economic changes in the sense that, the value of about 30% of our exports now comes from the export of oil. So we are rapidly becoming more and more dependent on one resource. We've had a very lackluster debate about the Dutch disease, but it's very much a pronounced fact in Canadian life.
Dutch disease, you're talking about the way the way it impacts on our currency levels.
That's correct. So the more oil we export, the more volatile and dependent our currency becomes on oil. In other words, it goes up and down with oil prices like a yo-yo. That's a big problem if you're a manufacturer and you were used to the Canadian dollar being worth 80 cents and now it's on par with the US dollar or more. That has really dramatically shrunk the manufacturing sector. It's not the only factor that is involved in that development, but about half of the job losses that we have seen in the manufacturing sector are very much due to this whole phenomenon of a petrocurrency and the Dutch disease. Now, there are lots of ways to address it. We haven't addressed it in Canada. You could stabilize your currency by putting your money that you have made from oil in a savings account, into a heritage fund, into a sovereign fund, into a pension fund. That would stabilize our currency, really help out the manufacturing sector. We haven't even had that debate in Canada. We also haven't had any debate in this country about the pace and scale of bitumen development. And that's really going to catch us up.
When you talk about that shift, that dramatic change that happened when Harper came into power, I'm wondering if you could give maybe a few concrete examples of actual policy initiatives that have somehow transformed us, the whole economic vision for the country.
Well, right now there's no diversity in our thinking. The vision is all about pulling resources out of the ground and exporting them raw as quickly as possible to Asian markets. I mean, that's it. That's really not much of a plan when you seriously look at Asian economies and how they have grown way too rapidly. And are enormously concentrated and corrupt and are about to have their own reality check. That's one concrete example. Another would be what Harper has done to make it possible to develop many of these resources far too quickly. He introduced a bill, an omnibus bill last spring, that gutted Canada's Environmental Assessment Act. This same bill gutted our Fisheries Act to make it easier to build pipelines. We have subsequently gutted the Navigable Waters Act. The government has cut funding to almost every major scientific institution in the country, whether it was doing basic research or monitoring that might somehow put forward evidence that might slow down resource development of any kind.
So you, you're saying all of these changes are linked specifically with the tar sands?
They're very much linked to lobbying by big oil and also lobbying by Enbridge and by pipeline companies. Their lobbyists directly requested many of these changes. The other thing that's going on here is that Canada, frankly, is producing too much bitumen at this point in time. The Alberta government has approved more than 100 projects since 1998, both mining projects and steam plants. And so we've gone from 600,000 barrels a day to nearly 2 million barrels a day. We've driven down the price of bitumen in U.S. markets as a consequence. And so both the Alberta government and the federal government have a problem on their hands. So they've overproduced a resource that is among the world's costliest hydrocarbons to produce. They haven't got reliable markets for them anymore. In fact, oil demand in the United States is going down at the same time that domestic oil production is increasing. So they've got a problem. And they figure the solution, well, the market-based solution would be, okay, we better slow down. But it seems that nobody in Ottawa really actually believes in market-based solutions. So with massive government intervention in the form of the rewriting of environmental legislation, as well as the really stupid treaty signing that the federal government has now done with the Communist Party of China to accelerate and promote Chinese investment in the tar sands. And it's all about getting the Chinese to pour money into places that nobody else really wants to pour because they realize the risks are getting too high given the cost of bitumen production and also given the fact that at some point somebody's going to put a price on carbon. And when they do, that's going to dramatically slow down the tar sands.
So it isn't really even about energy or energy security.
It's fundamentally about greed. It's about how do I protect my political base in Alberta, which is totally dependent on the export of hydrocarbons. Oh, I can do this by selling out the country and signing treaties with the Communist Party of China that allows their state-owned enterprises, which are among the most corrupt in China and also the most hated in that country by ordinary people, to gobble up a sizable chunk of bitumen production in Canada. All of the polls say the average Canadian thinks that is a pretty sorry-assed solution to the problem. They don't like it. They don't want state-owned corporations from China owning Canadian resources, period.
Yeah. Just looking at the tar sands for the time being, would you say that it is a boon or does it compromise Canada's energy security?
Well, we haven't even thought of it in those terms. I mean, half the country right now is dependent on foreign oil. So Quebec and Atlantic Canada get all of their oil from the North Sea or North Africa or from Iraq. That's another problem all in itself. But we don't have any energy strategy at all in this country. I mean, it's all, we'll let the market take it wherever the market wants to take it, even if we have to fix, manipulate, and engineer that market to please big oil.
Back in the 1980s and today, the National Energy Program, or a National Energy Program, was very viciously attacked on the grounds that it was seen as Ottawa and the East basically trying to capitalize and colonize the resources of the West. So how would you, do you see any merit in that viewpoint? And do you, are we better off today with more control on the part of the province?
Well, not really. The industry did a very good job of, there were a lot of problems with the federal National Energy Program. So, I'm not going to defend it. Some of the ideas behind it were not bad ideas. They were actually good ideas. But the whole thing was delivered very poorly and actually really acted as a resource grab and revenue grab by the federal government. But just because we had that one experience, and doesn't mean then that we can no longer sit down and talk about energy planning for the country. I mean, that's how ridiculous is that? The other thing too is that big oil also. You know, there was an oil price shock in the 70s and then an oil price collapse in the 1980s. The big oil, which is, you know, really one of the world's most phenomenally powerful collection of corporations on the planet and also the most lucrative, spent a lot of money tarring the National Energy Program as, you know, as this resource baron or robber of resources, when in fact it was really the collapse of oil prices that caused a lot of problems in Alberta that nobody had really adequately paid for, prepared for. But here's another issue, I guess, that I think is extremely important. All right, so Canada is a major oil exporter now. Most of our oil is now going to the United States. We've had no conversation about pace and scale. We've also had no conversation about the money. So what should we be doing with the money? Should we be using the money to run government, or should we be using the money to save for future generations and prepare for an energy transition? The Norwegians had a conversation about this. They said, hey, this money will corrupt us. We're going to set it aside for future generations. And to keep our governments honest and accountable, they will run on taxes. Because if you are not taxing your citizens, you are not representing them. So we have the phenomenon in Alberta where 30% of our revenue comes from hydrocarbons, from big oil. And as a consequence, the government of Alberta no longer really truly represents Albertans. It represents the resource, or it represents the resource developers. It is not representing Albertans. And so when you make that bargain and when you say, okay, we'll run on the resource revenue as opposed to, hey, let's live within our means and run on taxes. And if we run on taxes, then we have to represent those people and we have to come back and actually talk to them and consult with them. If you make that mistake, you really are entering classic petrostate territory, because that's what happens in Saudi Arabia, Louisiana, and Texas. The bargain has been made. Those governments are running on this sort of heritage loot from hydrocarbons and squandering the capital. We've had no discussion in this country about the money. Who's getting the money? Why isn't it being saved? So the Harper government now, it makes about $5 billion a year in revenue from corporate taxes, from bitumen production. Not a penny of that is being saved for future generations. It is effectively using that money to manipulate and corrupt the political process in the country. I think that should be illegal. And, you know, the Norwegians got it right. 90% of their resource revenue is set aside and they run on taxes.
And in terms of, I mean, given that the oil seems to have so much power in terms of the way things happen at the political level.
It's a $2 trillion industry in the world, and the oil industry and oil exporting nations are now draining oil importing countries of their capital and their wealth. And so we're seeing this massive transfer of capital and wealth from oil importers to oil exporters.
Do you see any concrete example of how the power of oil is corrupting media coverage of the tar sands, pipelines, and what have you?
Well, it's probably a bit of a more complicated story in the sense that you have the media in a state of dissolution and transition. So the media is getting smaller. By its nature, its ownership is more and more concentrated. And as a reality, you know, the owners of massive media conglomerates tend to shop and dine with with other rich people, right? And so their interests tend to converge. The other thing about big oil is that it has enormous resources and power, and you can't go to an internet site, you can't turn on your TV or on your radio without listening to propaganda from big oil or from the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. I mean, these guys have got money to burn, and they're burning it on media airwaves.
And there's also ethical oil.
Well, ethical oil is very much the creature. I mean, it's a propaganda scam, and it's a creature of Stephen Harper's political office in the sense that most of the people associated with ethical oil have at one time or another worked for Harper on political campaigns. So it's very much a political creature, and it's everyone in the oil patch knows that, that oil is about money. It's not about ethics. And so, you know, it's a convenient scam to get people to stop thinking and to stop asking the real questions. Well, what about the money in this country? How is oil exports changed other parts of our economy? What about the Dutch disease? How are we going to respond to it? What about our moral obligations to deal with the issue of climate change? What about a carbon tax? And by then calling this resource ethical, you're sort of saying, hey, shut up, everyone. You know, Canadians are nice people. Canadians would never do anything bad. Yet every major player in the oil sands is morally compromised in one way or another and has done bad stuff all over the world. I mean, Total, oil sands investor, has dealt with Burmese dictators. Shell has dealt with the bloodiest minded warlords that you can find in Nigeria. ExxonMobil is there, and of course, you know, they're funding the Republican Party in the United States. Nobody is clean in the oil business. But it's very much a signature and a testament to the fact that Canada has got a petro-state when the ethical oil crowd is essentially run out of an office of from the Prime Minister.
So as you see it then, Andrew, just to wind up, is Canada doomed to be a petro-state, or can we reasonably transition away from that kind of status to a more diversified economy?
Well, we're doomed if we don't have a conversation and a debate about this. And this is, you know, as a journalist and as a reporter since 2008, I've written the things I have written to get Canadians to some kind of point where they debate this. We are natural resource developers. That's what we do. We're miners, in effect. What we don't want to recognize is that oil is a fundamentally different kind of product just because of all the money associated with it. And I think we're afraid to have a debate about the pace and scale because, let's face it, it's going to be a brutal debate. We're already kind of having it about pipelines. But fundamentally, it becomes a debate about our character as a people. So why are we doing this? Are we doing this to put more friggin' cars on the road in Shanghai? Are we doing this to increase the rate at which the oceans acidify? Are we doing this to destabilize the planet and the planet's atmosphere? Are we doing this so China can send us more cheap stuff that we don't need? We're afraid to ask those moral kinds of questions. We're also afraid to say, you know, well, so then maybe bitumen production has been a real curse to this country, and that maybe what we really need is a plan to get off this resource, not to accelerate its production. And that truly is what we do need, and that's where the conversation and debate by necessity, by clear moral necessity, will ultimately lead. And we're afraid of that as a people.
Well, Andrew Nikiforuk, these are rather profound questions and questions that I would agree are desperately in need of debate. So I want to thank you very much for helping to open that discussion.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Michael.
Thank you. That was journalist and author Andrew Nikiforuk speaking on the politics of the Alberta tar sands. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner stations across the country, and podcast on the website for the Center for Research on Globalization. I'm series host and producer, Michael Welch. I'm speaking right now with Steve Lendman. He is the Chicago-based host of the Progressive Radio News Hour. He is a writer and broadcaster. He's the author of the recently published How Wall Street Fleeces America: Privatized Banking, Government Collusion, and Class War. He's a frequent contributor to the Center for Research on Globalization, and he's also a recipient of the 2011 Mexican Press Club's Award for International Investigative Journalism. He also wrote recently an article for Global Research called Petraeus Resignation or Sacking. So we're just going to start our conversation with that article. Do you want to talk a little bit about Mr. Petraeus's significance in terms of the Obama administration and the larger geopolitical context?
Oh, indeed. I don't think Petraeus is leaving. I'll call it that for the time being. I don't think his leaving had anything to do with his sexual dalliance. It very rarely brings anybody down. Certainly doesn't in Western societies. If something like this happened in France, if anybody complained about it, they'd be laughed at. Former French premiers like Mitterrand. It was well known that he had an affair, maybe with more than one woman, but it seems to go on quite commonly. It goes on commonly in America. In my article, I mentioned Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House. He resigned as Speaker, but it had nothing to do with two ethics scandals that he overcame. One was a sex scandal, the other was an ethics scandal, and neither one of them laid a glove on him. But he resigned after the 1998 off-year elections when Republicans in the House had a bad year, and they blamed the Speaker, and he stepped down. And the Speaker-elect was a representative by the name of Bob Livingston. He had his own sexual affair problem. He resigned, but it wasn't because of the sexual affair. It was because he decided he would leave and take a job as a high-paid Washington lobbyist. So this doesn't bring people down. So what on earth got Petraeus sacked? And I absolutely believe he was sacked. Well, they could have been. I don't think it was incompetence. He absolutely was incompetent. Petraeus didn't achieve his so-called fame because of any competence on the battlefield. He failed in Iraq. He failed in Afghanistan. But he brown-nosed his way to the top. He fabricated successes. He suppressed his failures. He got 4 stars by doing it. And I think what brought him down, Michael, was in 2010. He testified before a couple of congressional committees, I believe House and Senate committees, and he took on the Israeli lobby. Well, doing that in America is the kiss of death. You take on the Israeli lobby, and they can have your scalp for the asking. But basically what he told the congressional committees was, there are some times when U.S. and Israeli issues conflict, and going along with what Israel wants at times harms U.S. interests. At these times, America should say no. Cut the cord and not support Israel. Support Israel when it benefits America as well. When it doesn't, cut the cord. The Anti-Defamation League went bonkers. The second oldest Zionist organization in the country. Next year it'll be 100 years old. Abe Foxman, the general director, or national director, whatever he calls himself, he wrote a scathing comment about Petraeus, what Petraeus had to say. And I'm certain the other Zionist organizations felt the same way, AIPAC and all of them. Which ones made a public statement, I don't know. But I'm sure they were very upset about that. And that was the kiss of death for him, I believe. And I think that's what brought him down.
I think the first time I ever heard of General Petraeus, it was in the context of the infamous surge, which everybody, including Obama, is citing as being the main reason for the curtailment of violence in Iraq. You're saying that basically that there's more to that than what is available in the mainstream press.
Oh, absolutely. The surge had nothing to do with the violence calming down. The violence calmed down because they bribed the opposition, Michael. they paid them off.
Yeah.
You know, you grease somebody's palm with enough money, and you can pretty much get them to go along with an awful lot. And in this case, they got them to stop the shooting and stop the killing. But you will notice, if you pay attention, that there is violence going on in Iraq in multiple areas every single day. Car bombs going off, people being killed, many people being hurt. I say Iraq is still a war zone. It's on a low simmer. compared to, you know, when large numbers of U.S. forces were there. But there are still thousands of U.S. forces there. I think they keep a low profile on the major bases where they operate from. And America controls the skies over the country. But I consider Iraq still a war zone and a failure. I consider it another war America lost. I've said a number of times in articles that America has not won a war since World War II. That was the last one. It lost every single war after that it fought. There were no successes. Libya is a failure. Iraq is a failure. Afghanistan's a failure. Syria so far is a failure. And even if they get rid of a government and get a puppet regime to replace it, it's still a failure if the violence continues. Libya doesn't get much attention in the major media, but it is literally a cauldron of violence, and it's going on across the country, and the so-called government is little more than what Hamid Karzai is in Afghanistan. He's essentially the mayor of Kabul, and the government in Libya, I wouldn't even call them the mayor of Tripoli, because there's an awful lot of violence that goes on in Tripoli. And if they wanted to bring him down, they could do it, and they might just decide one of these days that they will take the government down. They've stormed the parliament at least one time that I wrote about. I imagine maybe more things they've done as well that I'm not quite aware of. But there's violence that goes on all the time. They're killing and they're shooting, and these people have weapons. They have powerful weapons. So that's another country that is in absolute turmoil. All the countries that America has attacked, at least since 9/11, Michael, literally are cauldrons.
I wanted, if we could just like sort of tie in the Petraeus angle again, because you also noted in your article that, and you were just talking about Libya, Benghazi and that whole operation, you call it an operation and not a consulate, that somehow Petraeus's resignation was just before he was supposed to testify on the killings of diplomats in Benghazi. How is that Benghazi operation related to the wider imperial agenda that you've been referring to?
Well, it could be related, at least in the House, Michael, because the House is controlled by Republicans. And if they want to beat up on Obama, you know, you have to find the soft spots. So Benghazi is a soft spot. What happened in Benghazi, I certainly don't know for sure. My sense, and I could be wrong, this was based on an article I quoted from that two other people wrote. My sense is that the killing in Benghazi was done by the so-called Jamahiriya resistance. These are the people who want nothing to do with their country being occupied. They're not the militants, these death squads that are running around killing people left and right. This is the legitimate people of Libya that simply want to live free the way they were before, under their own government, running themselves. They don't want any foreigners telling them what to do. They don't want any death squads running around the country. And other people and myself refer to them as the Jamahiriya resistance or the green resistance. Solid green flag was the Libyan flag under Gaddafi. So they take the name the green resistance. And Jamahiriya really refers to the kind of governance that existed under Gaddafi. And it really did wonders for the people. It was a social state where marvelous benefits were provided to people, and they're all gone now. Gaddafi was no model leader, but he used the country's wealth. He distributed it not among the privileged people alone in Libya. He wanted everybody to have it. He didn't like the idea that anybody should be without a home. He did incredible things. He provided free education, free health care. He actually gave us a very large stipend to newly married Libyans. It's astonishing what he did, and it was in what he called his Green Book. And this came into existence, maybe 10 years after he came to power in 1969. It might have been in the late 1970s that it all began. But this is all gone now. this, it's worse than that, because so many Libyans have been displaced, so many were killed. Poverty has got to be at huge levels, because there are no government programs that I'm aware of that are helping anybody. And again, violence is raging on a daily basis. So you could understand that people want their own country back. They want to end the violence. They want to run their own country. They want to control their own lives. And the way to do it is they got to get rid of NATO. They got to get rid of America. They got to get rid of this puppet government. And they got to get rid of these roving death squads that are killing people, anybody they suspect of being pro-Gaddafi. Well, Gaddafi's gone. The issue now is what goes forward for Libya, and it certainly isn't what the majority of people in the country want. So you've got this struggle going on. And last year, I wrote constantly about what was happening, and I honestly believe then and now that there would be a protracted struggle that could go on for many years in the future, and the violence wouldn't end. And so far, a year later, we see it happening. A year from today, it still could be happening. I have no idea when it would end, but my feeling is that the Green Resistance killed Ambassador Stevens. Whether it's true or not, I have no documented evidence to prove it, but that's my suspicion.
Mm.
But it's easy to pick a soft spot, Michael, and blame it on Petraeus, and then blame it on Obama. You know, whatever you can pin on Petraeus, you can pin on Obama.
Now, of course, Obama is the newly re-elected president of the United States. And I mean, there was some suggestions of, divisions in terms of who Netanyahu in Israel would have preferred to be president. And I think Mr. Petraeus had been pretty clear about which party he was more affiliated with. I'm wondering now, as we move ahead, where things sit now that Obama's got the next 4 years to work with, Petraeus for whatever reason is out. There's General John Allen who's seems to be out, and I guess all of the most, if not all of the leftovers from the Bush administration are gone. He can assert his own foreign policy. So when you look around at some of the recent happenings right now in Israel and Syria, what is your projection for, say, going into the 6 months into the future about where things sit in terms of U.S. involvement militarily?
Well, of course, nobody is an oracle, and the Obama administration will craft its policy as it goes along. But I've written before, Michael, and I would say it again, that I really think that things absolutely will not get better in Obama's second term. And I honestly think they'll be worse than the worst of the first term, that I've written so many times saying that Obama did what his supporters thought was impossible. He exceeded the worst of George Bush. He continued Bush wars. He waged his own. He plotted coups. A couple of them succeeded. He tried a number of things, a number of initiatives against ordinary people. He waged more proxy wars. He got along, well, I consider Libya and Syria American wars. You can call them proxy wars if you like, but I consider them American wars, planned in Washington. They never would have happened if Washington didn't want them. And these are Obama's wars. Well, he inherited the plans from previous administrations. I think these things were planned many years ago. I think it goes back probably to the 1990s. That the regime change was planned, and post 9/11, the scheme began to unfold one country at a time, and proxy wars. You have multiple ones going on. So you've got right now. You've got them in Syria. You've got them in Yemen, in Somalia, there are small things that are going on in other countries. But America has got its hands on all of this stuff on every continent. Violence that's going on that America has its hands on, and blood on its hands because of this stuff, and funding the kind of people who serve America's imperial interests. And what will Obama do in the second term? Exactly what he's done in the first term, and if anything, I think he'll ratchet it up to a higher level. I greatly fear full-scale war in Syria and a possible full-scale war on Iran. And the best hope I have against this not happening is that I think there are people, I hope, enough people in high places in America and in Israel to say we want no part of this. If the Pentagon absolutely refused to fight these wars, there is absolutely nothing Obama can do. The Pentagon has got more power than he has. And I think there are high-level people in the Pentagon, especially Iran, who believe that a war against Iran is absolute madness. Well, I think a war against Syria, full scale, is madness as well. It'll spill over to neighboring countries. It'll affect Israel. It'll affect Jordan. Affect Lebanon. Who knows how far this will go? And will America win? Well, the track record is America hasn't won a war since World War II. So why should we believe America would prevail in this one? Oh, they'll destroy the country. They're very good at doing that. They could take out Assad. I'm sure they could get rid of him. They could kill him. They could put in a puppet regime. Will it solve anything? I don't think it'll solve anything. There'll be one more cauldron in the Middle East, courtesy of USA, and the beat goes on. Mm. And what would they do next? Take out Hezbollah in Lebanon, and then go after Iran, maybe start World War III? The possibility is real. I wrote an article where I said, the title was, Thoughts on Perhaps the Most Perilous Time in World History. I really think, Michael, what we're going through today is the most perilous time in world history. We've never had a situation where literally the threat of another global war exists, and the weapons available, not just to America, but to even some smaller countries, are weapons that literally could raise holy hell. Mass destruction, puts it mildly, you can destroy countries. You can create nuclear winter if you start using enough full-scale nuclear bombs. You can make them any strength. You can make them stronger. You can make them weaker. But even the ones that are a little less weak today, maybe on the order of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or you can make less powerful so-called bunker busters for more targeted strikes. America has those. And America has hydrogen bombs that, my God, they probably can blow up the whole state of Illinois where I live.
And this is at a time when
weapons that exist today.
Yeah.
It's very dangerous. And if you take this too far, there are other countries that have interests in the Middle East and in other areas, China, Russia. Will they simply sit back and let America do whatever it wants to do because they know that they represent the final frontier? You get rid of all the other countries that China and Russia have a good relationship with, and they all have puppet pro-Western states, and China and Russia are isolated. Will both of those countries simply stand by and let this happen, or will they draw a red line and try to stop it before it does? Well, if I were ruling these countries and I realized I can either take action now when it might be easier, even though I don't want to do it, or I can wait until I'm the Lone Ranger and I'm in it all by myself with nobody to be on my side and they're coming after me and I have to defend myself, would I want to do it then or would I want to do it now? I would want to do it now, and for one more reason. Countries like America, Michael, are bullies. Bullies like to pick on weaker nations. America hasn't fought a war since World War II with anybody they thought could fight back. They sure were wrong in Southeast Asia, Vietnam. And finally, they just they destroyed half the country, maybe the entire country, and the effects are still being felt. Mm. But they could have stayed. They could have kept fighting. They could have maybe leveled Hanoi and any place else that they wanted to do, even with the lower technology that existed in the 60s and 70s. But they pulled out. It was a lost cause. The other wars that were fought, the proxy ones, the direct ones, they were all lost. How much more of this do you want to do?
Not too much more, I hope.
I hope not, because yeah. I fear the worst if this goes too far. And I'm mindful of some past people in the Pentagon in the past. Thankfully, they were a small minority. But generals like Curtis LeMay, and there were some others that were as on the lunatic fringe as he was. Mm-hmm. And he and they, back in the 60s, I think LeMay during the Kennedy administration, wanted to nuke the Soviets because they were weak and America was strong, and this was the time to take them out. Well, they had nuclear weapons. They still were in pretty sad shape even that many years after World War II. But he wanted to nuke the Soviets when they were down. And the talk was, well, you know, so maybe they'll take out Philadelphia, Boston, and New York, but we can destroy the whole country. Mm. So that's a small price to pay. How do the people in New York feel about it?
Yeah.
And Philadelphia and Boston.
Yeah, you know.
Maybe Chicago.
Yeah.
Don't I get a vote?
No, apparently not. But I wanted also to bring in, I guess, some recent developments because, I mean, you spoke about the United States as being a big bully, and it does seem that there's a significant appendage or partner, call it what you like, that is Israel in terms of enacting their imperial ambitions in the Middle East. And I know that there's been some recent developments there where Israel is now considering the resumption of assassinations in Gaza. Did you have any thoughts to share? Because I know you've written a great deal about what you see as the injustice being perpetrated by the State of Israel against the Palestinian people.
Oh, indeed so. A very big issue in December, end of December 2008, Michael, December 27th, if I remember the date right, and it ran for about 3 weeks. Israel's Operation Cast Lead. This was a war on Gaza that killed over 1,400 people. 5,000 were wounded, many of them grievously wounded. There was mass destruction all over the country. And I've suggested and I've written and I've quoted people who believe there's a Cast Lead 2 coming, and what the timing of it would be, who knows. I honestly do believe another war in Gaza is planned. It's just a question of when Israel wants to launch it. It could happen any time. And these targeted killings go on all the time. There was a big one. There was a big one today. Since Saturday, Israel has been bombing and shelling Gaza, targeting civilians and civilian neighborhoods and civilian targets that have nothing to do with anything of a military nature. To attack preemptively is a bad enough war crime, Michael. To do it against civilians really crosses the line so egregiously. If there was any justice in the world, the Israelis would have been held to account for this a long time ago. But they do it all the time. They have a policy that came out of the 2006 Lebanon War. They call it Dahiya. That's the name of a Lebanese city that Israel leveled in that war, and they call it their Dahiya policy. And I've quoted Israeli generals in the past, the generals that were involved in that, and the comments were to the effect that when Israel goes to war, civilians are considered legitimate targets. The way to defeat a country is to hit it at its most vulnerable spots. So you target innocent civilians and civilian infrastructure, and Libya. Israel did it to Lebanon in 2006. It did it to Gaza in 2008 and 9. If there's another war, it'll do it all over again. There could be still another Lebanon war ahead. Very, very possible.
I'm struck and by Israel. Sorry, I'm struck by what I perceive as a bit of, and maybe you do as well, a double standard, because right now we're talking a lot about, you just talked about the prospect of war with Syria, the basis being that Bashar al-Assad is killing civilians, he's killing, you know, all these people, a terrible loss of life. So it seems like the international community is dealing with both situations differently. Are we talking a double standard, or is that maybe a little simplistic?
Oh, boy, is it a double standard, Michael. It's the grossest of hypocrisy, where America is really behind stoking all of the conflict and killing and destruction in Syria. I mean, mass destruction, mass killing, tens of thousands of people killed. It goes on every single day without end. And what Israel does to the Palestinians goes under the radar unnoticed. Obama has a news conference today, by the way, at 12:30 Central Time, 1:30 in Washington, Central Standard Time, and it's possible I may be asked to comment on it either while it's going on or when it's over. Press TV contacted me this morning about being alerted to be asked to comment on it. I'm sure this topic of what's going on in Gaza today will come up. There was a big event in Gaza today. Israel assassinated the military head of Hamas's, forget the name of their brigades. Qassem Brigades, I believe they're called. The military head, a man by the name of Ahmed Jabari. They killed him. Initial reports said they killed his close aide. Subsequent reports said that, no, he wasn't killed, but they killed Jabari. I believe they killed his son. He was in a car, which is the way Israel often does it, and probably a drone attack with a missile. They killed him. Rage followed from Gaza. Hamas and the other resistance groups wanted to end the violence. Israel has been bombing and shelling since Saturday. The resistance groups respond, as they have a right to do. What Israel did was premeditated aggression. What the Palestinians did was self-defense, but it's called terrorism. And, of course, this, the military heads for Hamas, or maybe Islamic Jihad has a military head also, these period are called terrorists. Well, I call them resistance fighters. That's what they are. And they have a right to respond. But there really is rage in Gaza right now over this assassination. And I mean, this stuff is going on right now. There could be bombs falling on Gaza right now as you and I are speaking. There'll be, you know, the reports will come out a little bit delayed, so I'll catch up on them as the news comes out and it's reported. But the killing of Jabari made world headlines instantly. I just checked a few. I Googled his name, and I saw a bunch of headlines, I think more in Europe than in America, but this will be picked up. But it'll be misreported, Michael. It'll be said that that Jabari was a terrorist, and he was attacking Israel, and Israel responded defensively, and they killed a terrorist. Well, that's a big lie. And all of these killings, to say that they're defensive killings, that's a big lie. This is cold-blooded murder. That's what it is. You call it targeted assassinations, killing. I call it cold-blooded murder. That's really what it is. They're war crimes. They're crimes against humanity. They're done against innocent people whose only crime is praying to the wrong God, as I like to say, Michael, and they want to live free on their own land. Palestine belongs to Palestinians. They want the occupation to end. They want to be recognized for what they are, a legitimate state that was declared, and Palestine became a state on November 15th in 1988, 24 years ago. 24 years ago tomorrow. That's the anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fact.
Well, Stephen
Lenin, they don't get the consideration that a sovereign state gets. They want it and they deserve it.
Stephen Lendman, I want to thank you very much for these insights. I know you've given a lot to us a lot to reflect on. So hopefully we'll be able to speak with you again in the not-too-distant future.
Oh, Michael, anytime.
That was writer and broadcaster Stephen Lendman speaking on U.S. foreign policy following the resignation of David Petraeus. And that's our show. The Global Research News Hour is broadcast every Thursday at 10 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM and on our partner stations across the country. You can download our podcasts from the Center for Research on Globalization's website at globalresearch.ca. I am host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.